This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Buddhism on Air, a weekly program on the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, presented by Tenzin Chozang, a monk in the Tibetan tradition. The program is sponsored by Yulan Zhu, Julie Wong, and the Buddha Youth Association. Hello, and welcome once more to this ongoing program of Dharma Radio. Last week we spoke about the four seals and what makes a good teacher-student relationship. In the beginning of the Buddhist spiritual journey, finding a good teacher is crucial because all our progress depends on our relationship with the teacher. As we mentioned in the previous program, even in studying mundane subjects, if we don't have a teacher, our progress is likely to be very slow and go off on all sorts of tangents. A good teacher will not only keep us on track, but also make sure we go as efficiently and as speedily as we are able. But that is enough on the spiritual friend. Now let's talk a little about enthusiasm. I don't know about you, but I can be quite a good procrastinator. Not that I'm quite as bad as the quote in a cartoon that appeared in the Washington Post some years back, "Never put off till tomorrow, which you can put off until next weekend." And that sounds like a husband's answer on a Saturday afternoon to his wife's nagging him to mow the lawns, doesn't it? But I can happily put off something only vaguely interesting that could be done right away for something else that brings a more immediate satisfaction. That, of course, is okay if what could be done right now is trivial. But if it's important, putting it off could have some serious consequences. And that really applies to Dharma practice. However, when we apply our energies to Dharma practice, it gets a bit complicated. We in the West have been schooled in the idea that when we want something, we should get it straight away. And if we don't, we either get very upset and angry, or we give up in despair. Mind you, "I want it and I want it now" is not only a Western phenomenon anymore. Some time ago, a Chinese woman's hysterics became one of the most viewed clips on YouTube. Evidently, she was booked on a plane from Hong Kong to San Francisco and made her way through the check-in and customs at the airport, but when boarding time came, she was nowhere to be found. Someone suggested she was browsing the duty-free shops. But anyway, the time came for the plane to leave, and so the airline took her bags off the plane and closed the boarding gate. Suddenly, she came running up, and when she was told she was too late, she threw the most childish hysterics, shouting, screaming, throwing herself on the ground and flailing about. Some enterprising airline employee caught the whole thing on a phone camera, and somehow it made its way onto YouTube and many of the world's news programs. The Chinese woman must have eventually got over it because she was evidently put on a later flight. Now, although most of us don't throw such a wobbly when our desires are frustrated, our attitude is much the same as the woman's, and if we don't get our way immediately, even if we don't show it, we feel quite upset. And this is what makes Dharma practice, as I said, complicated, because the results from practice will probably take a long time to show themselves. It is said the Buddha took three countless eons to become enlightened, so if we apply our usual impatient attitude to Dharma practice, it's pretty certain we're letting ourselves in for more than just a headache or two. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, if we think we do a bit of practice, go on a 3-year retreat, and voila, we'll be Buddha, we are being a little optimistic. When we first hear of the Buddha's teachings, it's easy to get very enthusiastic and start off quite keenly. But then when things don't happen in a bang-wallop fashion, we could become quite dispirited or even angry and give up the practice. That just means we fall back into the same old bad habits and rounds of dissatisfaction without a way to get out. So before we even start, it's a good idea to create a way to keep our enthusiasm on the boil, something we can go back to when practice seems tedious, dull, or just too hard. The Tibetan tradition recommends thinking on what it calls the precious human rebirth. This depends on a practitioner knowing something about the six realms which we can be born into, and that in turn relies on the Buddhist belief in rebirth. I'm going to briefly explain both of these concepts for people who don't know much about Buddhism. So to all those Buddhists listening, please practice a little patience, as you will know about them already. From a Buddhist point of view, we don't only have one life. We're born again and again into many lives as long as we subscribe to the wrong view I spoke about last week in discussing the second seal: all phenomena are selfless. Basically, as long as we think that things exist inherently and independently from their own side, we will generate emotions for or against them, and driven by those emotions, we will create actions that impel us from one life to another. Whether each life is generally happy or not depends on whether the motivation for the specific action that drove us was positive or negative. This, of course, is karma, which we'll go into in some detail in a later program. But for now, we will just say that we've had countless lives because we continually generate negative emotions and karma. Then you may ask, well, if that's true, once we are born into a human life, does that mean we will always be born human? And the short answer to that is no. Now, I know many species on this planet are on the brink of extinction, but if we consider how many species there are on Earth, we will realize they are practically uncountable. Yet, from a Buddhist perspective, they are only a tiny fraction of the kinds that inhabit this and many other universes. Beings take all kinds of rebirths, although in Buddhist texts, rebirths have been divided very broadly into six kinds. The worst kind is the one of the hells. Buddhist texts describe many hells, the main ones being eight hot and eight cold hells, each worse than the one before, though even in the least the suffering is much more than we on earth can conceive of. The next kind of rebirth is in what is called the Preta realm, also known as the Hungry Ghost realm, because it's mainly inhabited by beings with an overriding sense of lack that nothing can satisfy. You may not know of the term oniomania, but it refers to the mental disorder of a compulsive shopper, a shopaholic if you like. And yes, it's a real psychological disorder that people have written books about and psychologist types develop programs to help people with. I guess someone who relies on what we call retail therapy to bring them happiness is on the fringes of oniomania. Like the woman who buys a dress one weekend, wears it only once, and must have a new dress the next weekend. This illustrates the mind of prettas. No matter what they want, as soon as they get it, it doesn't satisfy, and they're off to get something else. It is said that many prettas suffer from extreme hunger and thirst and never find anything to eat or drink, or if they do, the food and drink just harms them. The third realm we can be born into is that of the animals. Now, we are more familiar with this realm. It includes everything living on earth that's not human or plant. That is, animals like lions, tigers, and your pet dog, reptiles like crocodiles and snakes, as well as birds and insects. And, of course, the fourth rebirth is as a human, which we're all most familiar with. The two other realms are those of the Asuras and the gods. The Asuras are said to be more powerful than humans and have many more pleasures, but they are like very ambitious middle managers in a big company. You know, such managers can earn a lot of money, live in very nice houses in posh suburbs, and drive Mercedes Benzes, but they're just hated when a colleague on their own level succeeds or gets promotion. So that this doesn't happen, they often try to stab their colleagues in the back, and also often trying to think of ways to push themselves up the ladder into the boss's job. The Asuras have that kind of mind type of relationship with the gods or Zuras. The gods are not anything like the Christian god, an all-powerful creator, but more like the Greek and Roman gods. They have fabulous palaces, magnificent partners, and constant hot and cold running pleasures. The Asuras want to take the place of the gods and even wage war on them, but are always defeated because the gods are so much more powerful than they are. However, some of the god realms are the result of very strong meditation practice, so they are much more of a blissful mental state rather than a physical existence. So these six, the hells, pretas, animals, humans, asuras and gods, are the realms the Buddha's teachings say we can be born into from any one life to another, depending on our karma. Obviously, we would not wish to be born in the hells or as an animal, but you might think it would be nice to be born as a god or even as an asura, as both have pretty good lives compared to humans. But the problem is that the gods and the asuras all die and then have to be reborn in another realm, most probably a much lower realm. So it's a bit like Bernie Madoff. One day he's living among the richest, most influential people in the world with a gloriously pleasant lifestyle, and the next he's facing life among the roughest of the rough in jail. Perhaps it would be better if we opted out of the whole six realms story altogether. In what we call the lower realms, that is the hells, the pretas and the animals, there's very little chance to come across the Dharma, or even if the beings do, they can't do anything with it. In the hells and among the pretas, suffering is so intense that no one even thinks of practicing the Dharma. Among the animals, while you can tell an animal about the Dharma until you're blue in the face, it won't understand a word you say. Even if the animal is Ivana Trump's pet poodle, wears a diamond-studded collar, and eats goose liver pate every day. Then the Asuras and gods are far too focused on the pleasures of their lives, and I guess in some cases on the infighting, to be bothered too much about trying to be free of suffering. In fact, some of the gods of the higher realms spend their long lives in very fine mental absorptions and experience no discomfort at all. So that leaves us humans. We're in a unique situation because we have enough of a mixture of suffering and pleasure to be able to realize that we want to get out of suffering altogether. We don't have so much suffering that we can't practice, even if we wanted to, and we don't have so much pleasure that our lives are totally filled up with champagne, caviar, and satin sheets. So our life is precious in the sense that we have the time and resources to be able to make a real effort to practice the Dharma and make progress on the spiritual path to final enlightenment. Of course, you could point out that this doesn't apply to every human being, and that is true. Some people in the world are so poor that their whole focus is on just maintaining a day-to-day existence. For instance, in some places in Africa, people have big problems getting enough food and drink, and others live in fearful situations, like the people in Darfur. And anyway, in such places, the respect for life is so low that even if people try to practice the Dharma, they would probably find it very difficult. Actually, in such places, it would not be easy for the Dharma to become established at all. Although the Buddha's teachings have spread to many countries in the world, they're not all that common in Africa, probably, I think, because of the people's poor regard for life in general. Also, I have heard that harmful spiritual forces in Africa are very strong. You will probably remember the destruction of the Bamiyan Buddha statues in Afghanistan in 2001 by the Taliban. It's interesting to note that when a Chinese Buddhist pilgrim, Xuan Yang, visited Bamiyan in the 7th century, he found it was a vibrant Buddhist center with more than 10 monasteries and over 1,000 monks. Even now, I understand, you can visit Bamiyan and wander through the caves where some of the monks lived. But now, to actually practice the Dharma there would probably be quite difficult, and if the Taliban have anything to do with it, dangerous. And how many Buddhists would you find in Middle Eastern countries like Iran and Iraq? If any, I should think they would probably keep it to themselves as much as possible. The point I'm trying to make is that in some places, even if you have a human rebirth, it doesn't mean that you have the opportunity to meet and practice what the Buddha taught. In places where, for instance, another religion is radically entrenched and whose views are in many ways contradictory to the Buddha's teachings, it may be too difficult to practice the Dharma. So in such cases, we couldn't say rebirth as a human is a precious human rebirth. Actually related to that, I heard of one amusing story about a New Zealander who went to pay respect to a high Tibetan Lama. The Lama, and I can't remember his name, asked the New Zealander where he came from, and when the Kiwi told him, the Lama said, "Oh, that's a barbarian country." Now before any patriotic Kiwi gets all hot under the collar, I should explain that what he meant was that New Zealand wasn't a country where Buddhism was established. He didn't mean New Zealand was a country where people wear animal skins and talk in grunts and squeals when they aren't eating one another. But still, the Lama was not very well educated about our little place at the bottom of the world. Buddhism has been in New Zealand for at least 30 years, and in the last 15 has really flourished with the influx of Asians. Anyway, that's a bit of a digression. If we are listing what makes up a precious human rebirth, we could say that poor health is another obstacle to being able to practice the Dharma. For instance, someone who's been born blind, deaf, or mute would find it quite hard. Buddhism relies heavily on reading texts and listening to teachings to gain knowledge, so such people really would be at a disadvantage. And of course, people with mental disabilities will also find it difficult to even begin to understand. Some of the Buddha's teachings are really complex, even hard to grasp for monks who've been studying them for ages, so we could hardly expect those with limited intellectual abilities to grasp what is going on. That being said, though, there's quite a famous story about a monk in the Buddha's time who couldn't get anything to stay in his head. He'd been born to a poor woman by the side of the road, and so she'd given him the name Small Road. He had an older brother the mother had called Big Road, because he too had been born on the side of the road, perhaps a highway. Anyway, Big Road became a monk, and so his little brother also wanted to be a monk. In due course he became one, but while Big Road was intelligent and made quite good progress, Little Road appeared quite stupid. If you gave him a four-line verse to learn, by the time he had memorized the second line, he would have forgotten the first. Big Road tried everything he could think of to teach him, but nothing seemed to work. So eventually, he told Little Road he was too useless and had to give up being a monk. Of course, this made the young monk very unhappy. But then, as he was leaving the monastic community, the Buddha came by and, seeing him so unhappy, asked him what the matter was. When Little Road told him, the Buddha said he didn't have to leave the monk's life and gave him a task to do. He told him he would have to sweep the courtyard of the monastery, reciting as he did so, "Out with the dirt, out with the dirt." Naturally, Little Road was very happy he could stay, and so applied himself diligently to his task, even though it seemed endless. By the time he finished sweeping the courtyard, the dust would have collected again, and he would have to start from the beginning once more. For a long time, this went on, and then one day it dawned on him that it wasn't the dirt in the courtyard the Buddha was telling him to clean, but the dirt of karma and afflictive emotion that was obscuring his mind. With this realization, he was quickly able to practice and understand the teachings and became a highly realized being, an arhat, free from all suffering, and even surpassing many of the monks who had been his superiors before. So even though we may seem to have many hurdles to overcome to practice the Dharma, with effort and determination, we can do it, even if it means spending our days sweeping while chanting, "Out with the dirt, out with the dirt." Now finally, our human life is precious because we've been born at a time when the Buddha has been born on earth. There are long stretches of time no Buddha has appeared and the teachings do not exist. We have the excellent good fortune, or karma if you like, to have been born in the time Shakyamuni Buddha came and taught. Of course, it would have been much better if we had been born when the Buddha was alive and get the explanations right from his mouth. But we can at least say that his teachings still remain, and many very learned and highly realized teachers have studied them and can explain them to us. So that's kind of the next best thing. What I've talked about up to now are what we call the eight freedoms. A precious human rebirth is defined as having these eight and also 10 endowments. The freedoms, again, are freedom from being born in the hells, as a preta, or as an animal or a god, and that's 4. Then freedom from being born in a barbarian land, as the Lama so prettily put it. Freedom from having health deficiencies, especially mental problems. Freedom from being born when a Buddha has not come. And finally, freedom from being born in a situation where the views are contradictory to the Buddha's teachings. Now let's look at the 10 endowments. This means, through our previous practice and having created good karma, we have 10 fortunate circumstances that permit us to follow the Dharma. The first of these is that we've been born humans. As we said before, out of all the realms, the human is considered the best, as we have the right physical and mental makeup to really understand the need for Dharma practice and to be able to embark on it. The second of the endowments is that we've been born in a central land. This means that we are in a place where the Buddhist teachings exist and can be followed. In general, such a place has monks and nuns, both novice and fully ordained, staying in it. In fact, without blowing my own horn in any way, for the Buddha's teachings to remain and grow in a country, that country must have monks and nuns. Even the Buddha himself said that where 4 or more monks were, there he was as well. But anyway, New Zealand now has several Buddhist temples and centres with quite a few monks and nuns, so we could be considered a central land. The next endowment is complete sense organs. This is similar to what we said before about not being blind, deaf or dumb. If our sense organs are all in good working order, we can say we have this endowment. Fourthly, we haven't committed what Buddhists call the 5 heinous actions. Normally, it's a little difficult to say what will arise for us at death time or what will happen between one life and another, so we cannot really say which realm we'll go to in our next life. However, if we commit any one of 5 particular actions, the immediate result at death time will be rebirth in a hell. Those 5 actions are killing your father, killing your mother, killing an arhat, drawing blood intentionally from a Buddha, and creating a schism within the community of monks and nuns. An immediate hell rebirth would inevitably result if we don't do anything to purify the karma of such actions. However, as you can imagine, it's not easy to free oneself of such karma. Some Buddhist schools say it's not possible, but others say it is. The 5th endowment is having faith in the triple jewel, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Of course, we can't achieve anything without faith, even in mundane activities. If you're a real estate agent, but have no faith in your selling ability, how can you make money selling houses? Similarly, if we're to make this life meaningful, we must have faith that the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha have the power to help us to do so. But this isn't the kind of faith that says, "Okay, I have faith in you, now please save me." Buddhism doesn't work that way. The faith we're talking about here is the faith that the Buddha was an accurate and truthful teacher, that if we practice his teachings, we will eventually free ourselves from suffering, and that the people who have already practiced and realized the teachings will be able to assist us on the way. The important point here is that if we practice the teachings, we will attain the result. This does away with the notion that just by putting our faith in the Buddha, everything will work out well for us. The Buddha never promised such a thing and actually said he could only show us the way, but we would have to do the work ourselves. The next 5 endowments follow one from the other. The first is that the Buddha has appeared in our era, so we have the opportunity to meet his teachings and practice following his instructions. Actually, of course, the Buddha died a very long time ago, so we haven't had the opportunity to meet him. But still, because he was born, became enlightened, and then taught, Many very great masters have been able to study and attain realizations. We can say that these great masters, who we regard as our teachers, are here in the place of the Buddha and have similar powers as the Buddha to lead us well along the path to enlightenment. Then the Buddha taught. Now sometimes when Buddhas are born into a world, they do not teach for one reason or another. Even Shakyamuni, after he became enlightened in Bodh Gaya, sat for some time wondering whether he should teach what he had discovered or not. He thought that people would not understand. Luckily for us, he did, and eventually decided to spread his knowledge, and so we can reap the benefit. Not only did the Buddha teach, but after more than 2,500 years, his teachings still remain in this world. The Dharma has been under threat many times. It even died out in its home country, India. But it has still managed to survive in other countries for 2.5 centuries. Although in each country it has taken a slightly different form, it still remains the Buddha Dharma, capable of helping beings to free themselves from their suffering. We in New Zealand are actually very lucky. In the countries where people are brought up Buddhists, they will more or less just slot into the tradition they are brought up in. As new to the Dharma and having just about every Buddhist tradition now established in New Zealand, we can really study each one and choose which tradition suits us best. The West has yet to create its own brand of Buddhism, so in the meantime, we can practice the tradition that best suited to our mind. That there are followers of the Dharma is the next endowment. Not only do we have the Buddha and his disciples as our role models, but we also have the highly accomplished masters and monks to guide us, and even just ordinary good monks to help us when we need it. Just imagine how hard it would be if you were the only Buddhist on the planet. Having other followers around is really very helpful for our practice. Finally, many people are keen to help if you really want to practice. For example, if you wanted to go on retreat, there will be practitioners who will be only too happy to help, perhaps seeing you have enough food, a good place to stay, and so on. Even just for everyday practice, people have set up temples and centers where we can go to learn, and usually such places are ready to help followers of the Buddha in any way they can. So those are the 10 endowments that go together with the 10 with the 8 freedoms and make up a precious human rebirth. We will go over them again briefly next week. And now our time is up. Thank you for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you again next week. Please dedicate any positive energy that we've created with this program today to gaining enlightenment, not only to help yourself, but also to help all the other beings who are suffering everywhere. I hope you'll join us again next week. Thank you and goodbye.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.